we're to teach the Bible as Christians, we must show a legitimate connection from our text to the gospel of Jesus Christ. So this is the cross is the death, and that little arrow up is the resurrection. Well, at this point now in our pathway for preparation, we want to take another turn. We want to come down the right side of this pathway and consider persuasion. Because the principle behind persuasion is teaching the Bible well is more than merely getting the text right. We also have to get it across. I think that's written on your notes for you. The Bible, teaching the Bible well is more than merely getting the text right. We also have to get it across. And we label this line persuasion. And so become clear on this idea of persuasion. We're persuaded every day about things, and we make persuasive arguments every day about things. For example, when you're driving down the highway, well, at least where I'm from, there's lots of billboards everywhere. Do you have billboards here? Okay, so I figured, right? Okay, and what are billboards trying to do? Persuade you to buy the latest iPhone because they take amazing pictures. Do you have those billboards here where they have? Yeah. Wow. There's like a picture of a piece of bread on the highway in Philadelphia that makes me think I need to get an iPhone because that's a beautiful piece of bread. It's really striking. Lately I've had a couple of representatives knock on my front door, asking for support for a specific political candidate. They're trying to persuade me to do something, right? Or you just walk into the grocery store and, you know, what are they trying to do? They're happy you're there to get your milk and your eggs, but they want to sell you that candy bar at the checkout line, right? Or they're going to put those sugar cereals, like, you know, as high as your kids' eyes are so that you're persuaded to buy those things. Persuasion happens all day, every day. When it comes to the scriptures, shouldn't this be even more important to us to persuade people of and persuade people to? Right? So that's what I want to convince us of today, that we need to be persuasive in our teaching. On your handout there, you have a little picture that somewhat explains this tension that we have as Bible teachers, where we have a teacher and we have this tension of being in our study and needing to bring that into a sermon, right? So I mean, it's fun to, like, I think it's probably fun for most of you to sit in your studies and, you know, work through the text and be making all these different connections. But how do you actually get that across to your audience? What, you know, you spend 8 hours in your study. You don't have 8 hours to bring all that information to your people, right? We need to consider the meaning of the text so that our message can get across, right? These two tensions. We have our text and we need to bring it to today. So the picture is just meant to show the tension that we have between getting the text right to getting it across. All right. In this persuasion line, back up here, we have multiple principles that are involved in this. And for the sake of time, I'm only going to give us two today. And honestly, these two I'm going to give you today deserve a full hour in themselves. And we usually do just spend a full hour on these, but I'm trying to give you two for the price of one. Because we want to know how to do this, right? How do we take it home? How do we get it across? And a lot of this is new material for the Simeon Trust. We've been developing it over the last couple of years. So if you've been to workshops, this could be totally brand new to you. Actually, I remember when we first started this, I don't know when it was when I was here, but I remember going through 5 different principles. Do you remember when I did that? The Bible for Life? I don't know. I'm looking at the ones who were probably there. And that was just too much, 5 in 1 hour. So we're going to do 2 and try to make a little bit of progress on it. So the first one that I want to talk about today is argument. So here's a principle for argument, and it is not on your sheet. So if you want to write it down, it's up there for you. I want to talk about making an argument. The principle is make an argument in order to persuade your audience of what the text says. Make an argument in order to persuade your audience of what the text says. Every teacher must fashion her message in ways that are best suited to persuade her listener. to convince her listener. We must make an argument for the sake of persuasion. I've heard it said that there is no making of disciples without the making of an argument. And of course, I'm not talking about being argumentative. No, that's not what I mean. What I mean is I don't want to just articulate something. I want to argue for it. I don't want to merely tell you about something. If I only do that, then I'm not persuading you with an argument through God's word for a changed life, for obedience, for a changed character, for belief that the Jesus is the Christ, right? So we need to consider, what is the argument of our message? What am I trying to convince my listeners of? What am I persuading them to? Now, to persuade you to the fact that we should be doing this, because I want to convince you that we should be making arguments, I want us to look in scripture to a preacher who did this. So we're in Gospels and Acts this week. Let's turn to the book of Acts, because we have lots of preachers in the book of Acts who are persuading people right and left. And I'm going to have you do this with a partner or at your tables. We're going to turn to Acts 17. I'm going to have us look at two different passages, and we're going to look at the Apostle Paul's preaching, and he's one of the best preachers ever. So here's what we're going to do. I have two sets of passages up there, one in chapter 17 and one in chapter 18. And I want you to ask two questions of these passages. I first want you to ask about Paul's preaching, specifically, what verbs are used to describe Paul's preaching in that column. Maybe I should do this. In that column. So in chapter 17, verses 2 and 3, and then in chapter 18, verses 4 and 5. What verbs are used to describe Paul's preaching? And then I want you to ask, what's the response? So he preached in a certain way. Well, what was the response to his preaching? And those are the verses that follow. Okay, is that clear? All right, take a few minutes, work with your table partners, and we'll come back together. Okay, why don't we come back together? I think you've had some time. We didn't totally finish some of our groups, I think, but some of us did, because I can tell you're chatting. So why don't we come back together and learn from everybody? Yeah, you finished. Way to go. I see a high five back there. What verbs are used to describe Paul's preaching? So remember this, we're thinking about teaching the word. So he was teaching the word, and what verbs are used to describe how he taught it? From the chapter 17 passage. He reasoned. Reasoned from the scriptures. What else? He explained. Yep. What else? Proved. Demonstrated. Proclaimed. Yes. Oh, these are great verbs, aren't they? I like these. I feel like I'm excited. Like I want to listen to him. I mean, he's not just, you know, if you want to hear about this guy named Jesus, who's the Christ, I can just give you some ideas about what I've learned about him, but it doesn't really matter. No, that is not at all what he was doing when he was teaching. He was reasoning with them. Let me reason with you. I got to explain some stuff to you so I can prove to you and demonstrate that this Jesus that I proclaim is the Christ. Believe it. Okay, what's the response? How did they respond to him? Some were persuaded. Yes. Don't we love to hear that? There were some who were persuaded. They made a move from one side to another. They were convinced of something. What else do we get? What are the responses? Is that it? They joined. What else? There were some who were not persuaded, but what did they do? Some formed a mob and attacked. Okay, that's pretty serious, I would say, right? I mean, that's actually never happened to me by the grace of God. But here's the deal. When we teach in ways that are actually working to persuade people to something, somebody's going to get upset if they're not persuaded. So this is meant to show us that he's causing ripples, right? And in some ways, we could and should expect that to happen in our own teaching ministry. But it's to prove the point that he is trying to convince people to something. He's trying to persuade them to something, even if they don't all agree. Okay, chapter 18. What are other preaching verbs used to describe, or verbs to describe Paul's preaching? Chapter 18. Testify, reason, persuade. Any others? Yeah, he was occupied with the word, right? This means he was all about it. Okay, what was the response there? So there's a similar verbs, right? We get the idea. He's trying to persuade. What's the response? Okay, we have some not great things right away. Opposed and reviled. What else? Oh my gosh. Okay, this is not good. Okay, what else? We get someone who did believe. And his whole household. And they were baptized. Wow. They were moved so much to the point that they wanted to be recognized with Christ in baptism. That's also pretty incredible. This response, even though they're sort of they're opposite responses. It's so clear that Paul is trying to persuade them to something. Ladies, this is what we have to do in our teaching. We cannot be content with, let me tell you about something. And if you believe it or not, it doesn't really matter. I want to be persuading people to the point that they're going to come up to me afterwards and be like, that was ridiculous what you were calling us to. I cannot believe that you would have said that in church. I can't believe that you would bring all these people together and try to make us believe in this person that you call Jesus Christ. That's ridiculous. I want someone to say that to me. Because that means I'm actually doing my job trying to convince them that they should believe. Of course, I do like the option of people being persuaded and baptized and believing too, right? Yes, I would really want that. So I hope in this exercise, we're seeing the need for persuasion. And you do that through an argument, right? What was that? What was our principal sentence again? Make an argument in order to persuade your audience of what the text says. Okay, how do we do this? How do we actually make an argument? Let me draw a picture and then I'm going to give us some strategies. Let's think of making an argument in this way. Who can guess what that is? It is. It's an hourglass. It is not a wine goblet, as many have guessed before. This is an hourglass. Okay, here's the deal. When we're in our study, this is somewhat the pathway for preparation in a little bit different package. In our study, we are considering things like exegesis, exegesis, like structure and context and things like that. We're thinking of theological reflection. Right? We're making that turn. And all of that has to sift down to that skinniest part of my argument sentence. I want to take all the work that I've done, if you think about the worksheet, in questions 1, 2, 3, and 4. So structure, context, author's argument, and theological reflection. And I want to get down to question number 5. What is that one idea, that one sentence argument that I want to get across to my listeners? And then from there, we have the rest of this hourglass, right? Where we think about things like our teaching outline, where we think about things like our application, where we think about things like adornments, which are like illustrations. And these are all aspects of persuasion, which let me just write that. All aspects of persuasion. Now you can see this is the same hourglass with the same sand in it, right? So the work that we do at the top, it better look pretty similar to the work that we do at the bottom. But I'm just trying to show that we need to take all that work and distill it down to that one sentence that will then flow out to the rest of our talk, right? Because, well, never mind. I'm not going to say that part because I'm not going to confuse us with too much. But let me just say that much. I'm going to give us some strategies, but are there any questions on this so far? On like this hourglass idea? But the strategies might make it come clearer, but Any clarification needed? Okay, strategies then. How do we do this? How do we come up with this one sentence? Listen, for all of the principles that we have, we try to give you strategies. Like we just had those three questions this morning for connecting to the gospel. Like what are like on the ground things I can actually bring into my study and use in the text or in my work on my computer, to come up with something. So first strategy is to come up with one sentence, but here's the key. I would love for us to try to make it 12 words or less. I see some jaws dropping. Okay, on the worksheet, we asked for one short sentence, don't we? I think we actually use that word, short. It's really hard to get it down to 12 words. I frequently start with a sentence. I have no idea how many words it is. And then I count them and I'm ruthless in cutting out the ones that perhaps are not absolutely essential to the main idea that I'm trying to get across. It really clarifies for you what you're trying to persuade your people to, right? So try to get down to 12 words. Second strategy, make the sentence text driven, meaning we try to think about how we want to say our main argument, you know, that one sentence, you know, what words we want to use. And we're thinking about it and we're trying to be creative because, you know, we're teaching our audience and we're not sure. And really what you should be doing is you should just be looking right down at the words of the text and see what's there and use those words that are there, right? There's no better words to use than the ones that God has already given us. So make it text-driven as possible. Don't try to be creative in coming up with new ways to say things that are already in the text, okay? Second strategy. Third strategy, it should be audience-informed. So this is a very interesting part of teaching where on your worksheet, so you have question number 5, what is your argument? That argument could be slightly different if you're teaching your women's Bible study versus teaching first and second graders versus teaching everybody that's non-Christian versus teaching a group on a campus, like for a campus ministry. It just depends on your audience. We were at lunch today. We were sitting with a few people working with Radius and just thinking about all of the cross-cultural ministries that they're going to, you know, the cross-cultural places that they'll be stepping into. What language do they need to use or how do they express the sentence? Really, it really matters. You really got to think about that. That's all I'm going to say about it. I want to say more. There's so much more I want to say about all these things, though I got to give you a 2-for-1 in this, right? So I realize that time is running out. So let's do 2 things then with this. With these strategies. Let's think about the exposition that we just heard today. There was an argument. There was something that Sarah was trying to convince us of. There was something that she was trying to prove to us. And I would ask you what that is, except for the sake of time, I'm just going to give it to you. This was her argument. The argument she was persuading us to. You see the testimony of the witnesses. Do you believe them? That's what she talked about, right? Isn't that what she talked about? Okay, good. Good job. It got across. That's right. You see the testimony of the witnesses. Do you believe them? So here's the first exercise that we're going to do related to argument. We're going to put the strategies into play, assessing this argument sentence. Sorry, Sarah, that we're doing this to you, but you can handle it, I'm sure. Okay, one sentence. Is it 12 words or less? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. What? Man, how did she even have one more to go? You want to add one in? No, I'm just kidding. You don't want to do that. No. But so clear, isn't it? That you could have put a lot more words in there, right? You could have talked about, you see the testimony of the 5 witnesses. I mean, she could have done that, right? But was it necessary that be in the argument that she's trying to persuade to you? Would it have mattered if there were 5 or 6 or 4? It just matters that there's witnesses, right? That there's a testimony. Is it text driven? Were those words in the text? testimony, witness, right? And I think the believe, I don't remember if it was in the text or if you got that from John 20 from the I can't remember. Is it in there? Oh, those who do not believe? Is that what you said, Lisa?
Well, it talks about you do not believe. How can you believe? Believe is definitely in there.
Yeah. Okay. Which is the, I don't have my notes up here. That it. There you go. Okay. Which was the, that was one of her points about, do you believe the sign or do you believe the witness? Right, because you had the four things that you did with each of the witnesses. Okay, my notes are at my place. But okay, so we have 12 words or less. We have text driven and then audience informed. I mean, we're a group of Bible teachers. I think it's pretty audience informed. I mean, this perhaps doesn't come across quite as much in the sentence as it does in the whole of the message, thinking about it being audience informed, right? Okay, so there's one example of an argument sentence that's using these strategies. Now I'm going to turn it on you. So we've already had a small group where two-thirds of you have presented a passage. Okay, so at your table, I want you to take out a worksheet that you've already presented. Don't take ones that you're about to present. Do one because then you'll have something to talk about in your small group later. Take one that somebody has already presented and try to see if it's not 12 words. Try to get it down to 12 words. See if you can do it. If there's words you need to change to make it text driven, try that. And it just work with what you have, by the way. Don't like rewrite it completely. Just work with what you have, whether it's right or not, it doesn't matter. Just work with what you have. Okay, 30 seconds are up. How was that process? Sometimes it's easier. Some people are still counting their words. I can see that. Anybody have a paragraph they're working to cut down? No, I'm kidding. Or how many semicolons do you have? We're not writing sentences like Paul does in his letters, right? Yes, those run-on sentences, we're not doing that. Okay, how was that? Was it nice to have some partners help you to X out some words? I mean, sometimes I need that. I need another set of eyes to just tell me, yeah, you don't need both those things. What's one word that can encapsulate both of them or, you know, whatever. Sometimes I really appreciate that. Can I have a brave soul that wants to share with us maybe their first argument sentence and then what they changed it to? You want to try? Yeah, why? That's great, man. I'm glad. Don't tell us the passage it's from, though. Just read the sentences. That is great. That's great. Wait. Before you say, what passage is this? John 3. So at least you're text driven in that, right? I mean, it's really good. Okay, now go for it. Okay. One can only enter the kingdom of God by being born again. So how many words is that? 9 words. Wow. And is it text driven still? 11? Okay. And it's still text driven, right? Entering the kingdom and being born again. Okay. And then audience informed. Sue, do you have a question?
Text driven and unique to the passage. Can you kind of tell that? Because I know that it's Nicodemus, because that's what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. But if I didn't know that, it could be an epistle. It could be from another place.
Oh, interesting. That is interesting. You'd have to think, could it be from another place? Because are there other places in scripture that talk about entering the kingdom and being born again in the same passage? We'd have to think about that. I don't know. There aren't any? You know the answer to this? You know your Bible. Catherine.
John's the only one that uses born again.
John's the only...
And First Peter
uses born again. That's right. He does use born again. But okay. But the question, Sue, that you're asking is the right question that we need to be asking, right? So when I do say text driven, I am saying use words in the text, but we also need to make sure that we are, let me see if I can say this rightly, that we are specific enough to know that it's about this text, about this passage, meaning we should not be too general. Because that does happen to me a lot when I'm trying to come down to that one idea, because I really like to use few words and I like to just be brief. I'm almost so brief that my sentence could be said about a lot of different passages in scripture and you wouldn't actually know it's about John 3. So it is a question that we always need to be asking. Maybe I need to add that somehow as another strategy. I have to think about that. Okay, questions. Questions about making an argument. Yep.
Can you explain more about the audience informed, what we need to look at?
Yeah. So being audience informed just means, so you have that main argument, that idea that you want to persuade your audience of. So you need to think about that one sentence. Is that good for the women that you're teaching before you? Or if, like, so she did use the words born again in that sentence, which are clearly from John 3. But if she were to be teaching an evangelistic talk to a group of college students, could she use those words, born again? Who's the campus worker in here? Could you use the words born again? Or would they just be like, what is she talking about? They might be a bit confused. So maybe you would want to change that to something else. I don't know. I mean, obviously we do want to be text driven. Yes, we do. But for the sake of our audience, to connect with them and not alienate them right off the bat, we may want to consider another way to say it. So that's the audience informed way about it. Do you want to add, Sarah?
I was going to ask a question.
Oh, is that enough clarification?
Yeah.
About being audience informed? Okay. So you're still talking about the same idea. It's just, how do you need to say it? And even like when you teach kids, you got to be very simple, maybe 9 words or less. I don't know. You just have to be really, really clear with them. Sarah.
All right. My question about using your argument in your talk.
Yes.
So my initial argument statement was don't miss the point. And then I thought, oh, that's not text driven. Don't miss the point. Who would know that unless you listen to the talk? If you listen to the talk, I think you'd understand that I was connecting the idea of point with witness. But how do you, but then I didn't actually say that specific argument sentence in my talk. So how do you think about your argument sentence versus how that comes out in the talk?
Yes. Okay. So here's where I am going to add something that I wasn't planning on adding, but I think it's going to be helpful here. So when you think about, let me go back up to this picture. When you think about this picture and how everything in the bottom half of that hourglass is what your talk is, it's your outline, it's everything you're saying, your outline, your applications, your illustrations, it's all of that. You're considering your audience in this. Okay, technically, your entire 30-minute talk, like what Sarah just gave, the entire thing actually is your argument. The whole 30 minutes, you are making an argument to people. But the sentence is the summary of the 30 minutes that you're going to say. That's why I labeled it the argument sentence, because it's the most distilled down version of your 30 minutes. So that being said, in your actual talk, you don't actually need to say your sentence if you don't want to, right? We have you put it on the worksheet for the purpose of, you know, us giving you feedback, right? So, and you can have in your mind, what is the thing that I need to be saying? But you all got her point, didn't you? I mean, when I put the argument up on the screen, you're like, oh yeah, that's what she was talking about. So you clearly got your point across, but you wouldn't necessarily have to say it specifically for us. But I'm sure many of you do. Like in most of my teaching, I do. Actually, I set it up in the very beginning. I tell you what I'm going to talk about and I give you the sentence and, you know, and you don't have to do it that way, but you can. Do you want to follow up? Did I answer it enough? That's good. Okay. Other questions about argument? You're ready for either the 2 for the price of 1 or we're in food comas after lunch. One or the other. I don't know. I mean, this is such an exciting talk to come after lunch, isn't it? Because we all want to know about how we can persuade people, how we can make talks. Okay, let's do it. Let's do the second one then, okay? All right, the second one we're going to talk about is arrangement. And here's the principle behind arrangement. Every part of your talk, from the first word to the last, must intentionally serve the talk's argument. Every part of the talk. From the very first word that you say to the very last word that you utter, it must intentionally serve the talk's argument. So we say then, your material must be arranged. Like it must be arranged in some way to get your argument across. Martin Lloyd-Jones was a great preacher, and he wrote a book called Preachers and Preaching. And here is what he has to say about arrangement, arranging your material. He says, if my sermon is not clear and ordered in my mind, I cannot preach it to others. That is why I regard this ordering and shaping of the sermon as most important. And I advocate that you should struggle with this until you get it into shape. If my sermon is not clear and ordered in my mind, I cannot preach it to others. So let me give you a picture. You done with this principal sentence? I'll put it back up at the very end. But let me give you a picture to help us understand then what this looks like from your study to an actual talk. Remember that tension that we have? Okay, in your study, you have done a lot of work on structure. And actually, that's one of the strategies that you start with, actually, is your structure. Let me do that at the same time. Let me talk about strategies here for arranging your material or, you know, making a teaching outline. The first one is to start with your structure. And I want to draw a picture that relates this idea of why we need to start with structure. So if I can draw it this way, your work in structure is kind of like exploring the terrain of a mountain range. I know you have some hills here nearby. I've seen them and they're beautiful because I don't have those right by where I am in Philadelphia, and they were wonderful. And when you want to go for a walk up and down those hills or on a mountain range, you are gearing up for an hour or so. You're putting on your hiking shoes. You're getting a backpack full of water. Maybe you have like some gloves that you need to put on, and you're going to be sweating. So you might have a towel with you, and you've got Cliff Bars for, protein and energy. Like you're in it for the long haul. You're ready to go, and you're going to be exploring the terrain of the text. You're going to be seeing the peaks and the valleys and going up and down, and you're loving it, and it's great. But when it comes time to then arrange your material for your audience, you cannot expect them to bring their hiking boots with them to church. They're not bringing extra bottles of water with them. Instead, you need to give them a seatbelt and put them in a helicopter, and you just need to take them. Oh, you want to show them the terrain of the text. You want to show them the peaks and valleys and what you did, what you saw in your study, but it's going a lot faster, right? You want them to see the flow of thought of the author, but you're doing it in a much faster way. Okay. So that's starting with structure in your strategy. But another strategy that you really have to think about, I mean, this is really key when you think about your arranging of material, is you need to think about transitions. You need to think about transitioning well. That is between your points. You need to be able to transition well between your points. I have another quote from somebody, Julius Kim. He wrote a really great book called Preaching the Whole Counsel of God, I believe it is. And that's an excellent book. I highly recommend it. So he says about transitions, the transitions between your points must connect the previous idea, propel you to the next idea, and relate to the sermon's argument. Okay, so if you cannot transition between your points, then you might have the wrong points in your outline. They have to be able to relate one another. You have to be able to transition, to make that propelling motion from one point to the next. Third strategy, you want clarification?
Will you say that quote one more
time? Yes, I will. The transitions between your points must connect the previous idea, propel you to the next idea, and relate to your argument. Okay. Then thirdly, strategy, make it memorable. Make it memorable. this strategy is not actually for the sake of your audience. And I know we probably have some women in here who are amazing at making great teaching outlines. And I'm really jealous because I'm not as good at that. But this is actually for your sake, because when you have to sit down and maybe you write a manuscript or you write a detailed outline, it takes time to do that. And I want you to have in your mind where you're going. I want you to have memorized, well, we should also have our argument sentence memorized too, but I want you to have memorized your teaching outline so that when you're writing point one, you know where you're going to go on point two, because you need to propel onto the next one. So make it memorable, more for your sake than for your audience's sake. And then lastly, there is much flexibility. There's much flexibility here. And you probably saw this on the worksheets that have already been presented. You know, some people have 3 points, some people have 5 points. It just depends. I mean, your talk might warrant like the gospel connection as its own point or something. So I don't want you to feel like, well, if I have 4 points in my structure, I must have 4 points in my outline. No, it doesn't work like that, right? Or if you did a plot arc, it doesn't mean your 5 points are setting, conflict, climax, resolution, new setting. It doesn't mean that, right? I don't know what it means. You're going to have to talk about that in your small groups, but there's much flexibility when it comes to arranging your material.